Hello, and welcome to Benyo Chats. If you're curious about the world, this show is for you. Is the traditional school system failing us? And what can we learn from a child-led way of education? On this episode, I speak to Naomi Fisher. Naomi is a clinical psychologist who has studied how children learn. Her work focuses on the importance of agency and choice in putting children in control of their learning and allowing them to flourish. Hope you enjoy the show. Please like and subscribe as it helps others find the podcast. Hey everyone, I'm super excited to be speaking to Naomi Fisher. And Naomi is a clinical psychologist. She has written a book, Changing Our Minds, How Children Can Take Control of Their Own Learning, which is an excellent look at self-directed education, or some in the UK would say home education, or in America, homeschool or unschooling. And it also covers a brief history of educational thought. Naomi, welcome.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be here.
Over 20 years ago, we studied experimental psychology and neuroscience together. And then you went off, did some PhD work with autistic people and children. Yeah. So tell me what you've learned and how you've ended up thinking about children and education and the route to where you've got to today.
What's happened to me since, you mean?
Yeah. Or even during.
Yeah. Or even during. Yeah, it's been a long way, hasn't it? It feels a long time ago that we were studying experimental psychology together. So I went off and did a PhD in autism then, and then I went on to do my doctorate in clinical psychology. And I started working as a clinical psychologist, and then I had my children. My oldest child is 14 and my youngest is 11. And I think I had my own unusual education experience because I actually went to 11 schools when growing up. So we moved around the world. I went to schools in Botswana, I went to schools in the Congo. I went to a state comprehensive school. I was at a boarding school. It was like, I was at a Steiner school at one point. I really got to try out the full range of educational experiences. And I think what that did to me was it kind of fostered a slight cynicism about the claims that the education system make, because as I moved from school to school, I would find that each school had quite strong an ethos about how they thought things should be done. And they tended to think this is the way things always should be done. And in fact, they make a big fuss about it. So the thing I remember most is that I was at an international school in the Congo where no one had uniform. We came back to the UK. Everyone had uniform, obviously. And it was quite strictly enforced. And it became an issue immediately. Like, we were having our skirts measured as we came in the door. And if your skirt was too long or too short, you know, you could be sent home. And I remember at the time thinking, this is really weird because, you know, at my last school, we all just wore jeans, basically, and nobody ever worried about it. In fact, skirts weren't really a thing. And it's weird that you've made us wear this thing and now you're making it into an issue if we don't wear it the way that you want to wear it. So I think that a kind of theme running through my whole life has been asking questions about control and why we control people, and particularly why we control children. So anyway, so to come back to post-study in adulthood, I did my clinical psychology doctorate, and I then started working as a clinical psychologist. I had my own children, and I quickly discovered that many of the things I'd learned as a clinical psychologist weren't as straightforward and simple as I thought they were. I couldn't just apply them to my own children. And also, as my children grew, I started to feel this real clash between what I'd learned as a psychologist and what I understood about how children grew and developed and what was going to happen to them in the education system. So my son was his July birthday, summer born, very, very active little boy, not really interested in reading, writing at all when he was sort of approaching four. So we actually had a place for him at the school down the road, excellent primary school. I went along for the day, the introductory day, and they gave us a list of keywords and they said, can you teach them these words over the summer? So I had my three-year-old, and it was a list of words like the, but, if. They were completely out of context. And I looked at this and I was like, wow, all of his learning up to now has been in context, meaningful for him, because he thought he wanted to learn things. And suddenly I am meant to bring this into our relationship of where I'm presenting this list of random words and I'm saying you need to learn how to read them. why would I do that? What's the point, actually? Won't I be teaching him things like actually reading isn't meaningful, you know, because it's such a thing for me that when we learn when something has meaning for us. So to cut long story short, we decided to home educate for, him and his sister, and she came along too. And the more that I did that, the more I was thinking all the time of how I thought psychological theory and what I was seeing happening in my children, that there was a really important story that needs to be told here, that I thought that the way that schools run doesn't take account of what we know of human psychology and human development. And it actually in many ways makes learning hard. And that maybe if we didn't do that, maybe things could be a lot easier.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I guess that rolls into things like over testing and how schools are and all of that. I hadn't understood that you traveled and been to quite so many schools yourself. So that's almost like a mini case study in cross-cultural studies.
Definitely.
As well as the catalyst of your own children and therefore reality coming up against theory. And obviously reality is the truth. It made me think that also in our studies, if you go back in time to the time of Piaget, or even before, you refer to the school that Tolstoy built.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That today there are kind of two broad schools of thought which have these deep historic roots. One of them, I think they might call it constructionist, but in even mm-hmm. ways, they tend to argue for this schools-based, rules-based, fact-based, curriculum-based mm-hmm. system where, you know, you from facts and these kind of learned knowledges does everything flow.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other school of thought, which I guess you could call progressive, but in any sense tends to be child-centered, emphasizes child agency and choice and curiosity-driven learning, has actually been around probably for longer, actually, if you go back all the way to thought. And some mm. people can even trace it to ancient Greece thought. And a lot of your ideas seem to center close into the second school of thought, but seem grounded in your psychological studies and things. And I was just interested in what do you think is maybe misunderstood and how you arrived there from, was it observing both your children and autistic people and just knowing, well, these are how we're meant to, or we seem to develop, we use, you know, real world situations, we learn in situ, we don't learn these kind of funny stripped down psychological tests, which are very important for psychological mm-hmm. models, but don't affect how our learning works. And then this kind of joy or learning or curiosity, which we see, and I think a lot of people see in very young children, you know, you can't stop them asking questions and things. And then, you know, this observation that a lot of people have, it kind of stops stops partly because parenting or adults or the system kind of tells it to stop. So I was kind of intrigued how that all catalyzed and come together, and whether you'd have any comments about my characterization of the kind of history of those two schools of thought was approximately correct.
Yeah, I mean, when people say to me, which they sometimes do, oh, your ideas are progressive, I generally say I think there's a different school of thought that's progressive. Which, because I think for me, the thing that is key about the way I see education and the way I see thought and learning and child development is that how the child feels about what they're doing is really important. How the child, the kind of center of the child being the person who is exploring the world. I love this idea from Alison Gopnik of child as scientist, child exploring, child asking questions, child hypothesizing. And I could really see that in my young children. You know, it was just happening all the time. And then I came across the traditionalist ideas, like the, you know, I was interested because they use cognitive psychology to back it up. They say these are cognitive science ideas. This is, and I was like, that's really interesting because I studied cognitive science for a long time. And, you know, this is one part of it, but this wasn't, they didn't boil it down to this. They didn't basically say, you know, when we did learning, memory and cognition, they didn't say we've sussed learning. This is how it works. This is the model. What we need to do is seat the children in rows, tell them what to do, test them frequently, do lots of retrieval practice, and they'll all get good test results. And that's learning. They didn't, did they? Learning, what I basically learned in those courses was that learning is really complicated and that there's loads of different things going on here. And I remember actually a supervision we had, particularly at university, where we were talking about learning, and our supervisor said, but you know, it's so easy to just reduce children down all the time. We're kind of reducing them down to this set of boxes, but they're actual children. And they are people, and they're complex, and they've got so much else going on. And when we start reducing them to a set of boxes, what have we lost? And of course, I wasn't a parent at the time, and I don't think I really got that until I had my own children. It's much easier to reduce children down to a set of boxes when you're not living with a three-year-old and seeing how it doesn't fit. But I really wanted, there's part of me, whenever I see something that I don't, doesn't jive with me, like this particular thing about, you know, the best way to learn, for children to learn, is to seat them in rows and tell them what they need to know. When I find something like that doesn't jive with me, my first instinct is to understand why they say it. I want to go and find out. So I went, so I go and read all the stuff about why this is right, you know, and I read all the books and I listen to the podcasts and I really, really try and get in depth about why they think this is right. Because when I understand why they think that, then I can start to develop my own critique. So that's very much what I did with that. But I thought, even when I read, because I also read about the kind of more progressive people, and I still felt that often in the field of more progressive education, there's still something missing. And it's still who is in control of this whole process. Even, you know, you can read very progressive educators, and it's all about how to form this, how to get the children to do what we think they should be doing. So let's give you a really good example. Lots of schools are set up along the lines of children spending loads of time on outdoor play. You know, that's their ethos. They have this idea of childhood. They would definitely call themselves progressive. They would say, you know, childhood is all about play, particularly about outdoor play, unstructured outdoor play. Let's provide them with loads of time to play in the forest, and bingo, we'll have sussed childhood. And obviously that's a gross characterization of what they do, but that's the ethos. And then you come across the child who wants to spend all their time playing on Minecraft, and who, the child who doesn't want to be in the forest, who finds that quite kind of, they just don't know what to do with themselves when they're in unstructured play in the forest. And then the model doesn't work, because although it's meant to be this model for everybody, in fact, it only suits certain children. And I think you find that across the board, the models, when the model actually meets the child, and when they meet a whole range of children, then that's when you see the problems. So that's why, for me, the key thing I always ask when I'm looking at any educational model is, does the child have agency here? Can they choose to leave? And if they can choose to leave, then I think that makes all the difference. And this is what I think, this is what is a big difference with home education and kids in school. And I think you see parents go through this learning process when their kids don't go to school or come out of school, which is that children at home have a lot more power, because they're in their homes. You know, they have their stuff upstairs, they have their things that they do. If they really don't want to do what you're doing with them, generally they can stand up and walk out, and they do. Whereas at school, they can't do that. And just that simple fact means that home educators have to get alongside their children in a different way. They cannot rely on control, peer pressure. You know, you can't leave this classroom because there's nowhere to go. You can't, if you get up and walk out, then we're going to, you know, you, there will be consequences. They just can't rely on that. So they have to find a different way forwards.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. So under sort of this language, you've got traditional schools, and we can come back to maybe how Victorians kind of set it up to control their population to read and write because they needed to power the Industrial Revolution and all of the thinking around that. And you might have progressive schools, but they may be child-centered or child-led, but they may not be child-centered and child-led. And regardless
of
whether
they think of themselves as child-led.
Yes. But if you force people to be in the woods, say, that's potentially the same errors as forcing people to be in the classroom because the child doesn't have agency and is not led. And I think that makes a lot of sense to me. And I've now met, like you, and actually to my initial surprise, many people who were unhappy at school. So I was pretty happy at school.
Yeah.
And now I go back and ask a lot of my friends there and things. And, you know, again, this is not a significant N, you probably have the study, but I would say at least half of them weren't that happy. Yeah. And then another quarter were kind of neutral. So I would say like maybe half were sort of saying, you know, score average to below average. Another quarter was sort of no average, that's fine. And then maybe only a quarter were in my camp who actually actively
really liked it.
Got quite a lot of it. And I reflected that that's a really small number. And then I've seen some studies which seem to say, well, the surveys are always a little bit tricky, but seem to kind of hone in on the same number. And now I've met many people who are homeschooled. They tend to say this in America, whereas in the UK, they prefer home education to like that distinguishing between the structure of school. Or in the US, they might say unschooled people, or some people say de-schooled if you've been in school, and then that, who have turned out to be pretty happy going up. I'm not quite sure maybe why I've met quite so many now, but I have, and they've gone through a different route, and they've ended up roughly in the same place, given all everything, but still, I think actually every one of them I've met have had essentially their curiosity intact and everything else. Not saying that some other typical schoolers might not have, but it some of them it seems to have died out, which I kind of also find really interesting. And I guess maybe another blob for me is seeing people who've gone who are either autistic or have had other needs or learn differently or things like that. I've seen a lot of them now also, if they've been able to go into a different way of learning or system outside this institution, and they have flourished. Obviously not for everyone and everything's and there's all of these kind of complications around it. And I've also found that observation really interesting. If the stat system is not working for so many people, you know, why can that be, and can we not do more about it? And I don't know whether that resonates with you, and if you've ever any thoughts around how that is, or whether you feel that's maybe right in the kind of work that you've done.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you say that so many of your peers weren't happy at school, because I'm thinking, I can't remember where you went to school, but I'm thinking you went to somewhere that was perceived as an excellent school, right? So, because I suppose what the interesting thing for me was that in my tour through 11 different schools of the world, I went to schools that I really loved, and I also went to schools that I really hated. And I had that experience for myself. I particularly had the experience actually of having been mostly socially okay at school. And I went to one particular school where I was suddenly the outcast. And it was when we came back from Congo, and I went into this school where they had all been together as a class since they were like five. You know, it was one of these schools where they kept everyone together. I went there, and I was the one that nobody liked. And it was horrible. Of course it was horrible. But what was so interesting for me is that there was a boy in the class as well who nobody liked. And I remembered from previous school experiences that there was so often the child who nobody liked and nobody would play with. But I'd never been them before. And I remember that moment of thinking, I haven't changed. I'm still the same person. And at my last school, I had friends, I was happy, I was a valued member of the community. Here, I'm the outcast that nobody wants to have anything to do with. And it just made me think, even at the time, at 14, like the environment that you're in makes such a difference to different people, but also that there's no fixed right environment for people. We can't provide one environment which is right for all young people and children. You know, it's a bit like the forest school. We provide this lovely, parents go and see these schools and they think this is so lovely, it's so beautiful. And then the child gets there and they're like, no, this isn't for me. And so a school that for you could have been wonderful and excellent and exactly what you wanted, for one of your peers could have been a frightening and hostile place. And it's the same school, because it's about what we bring and how that interacts with our environment.
Exactly. And that's it. And, you know, my school is really high regarded, and actually let me follow my curiosity a lot. I ended up doing A-level art as well as theatre, as well as sciences.
Which is amazing, because you then went to university to do science.
And I did, you know, and I still did a theatre and all of that. But, you know, I know a lot of people who were unhappy. So it definitely does that. And I still remember the silly quirks, which I sort of felt like that, like, well, uniform, or I really clearly remember that you couldn't wear a coloured jumper, and just seemed really ridiculous to me, but also it is not something which I know impacted me that much, but I still remember it to this day. So it, you know, you wouldn't class that in any form of trauma, but the fact that I remember something so clearly from, like, you know, almost 30 years ago obviously had had that sort of impact. And then I really see it now, you know, thinking about the autistic community, because it's so obvious that autistic thinkers often don't work very well in school institutions. But then I observe that, and I observe it in a whole range of autistic thinkers. And it strikes me that a lot of what applies to them actually applies to people who don't have such an autistic cognitive profile as well. So it kind of goes the other way. It's kind of like, yeah, well, what should we be learning for what, you know, autistic thinkers might do or need or think? And some of that might be sensory. Some of that is following the center led for where you are there. So I guess I'm kind of interested in, what do you think are the barriers in the system? I think the UK, the government has made it harder. The US is sort of a movement which kind of, depending on the state, seems to go and sort of in parallel and fly under the kind of, you know, the regulatory radar, but they have a sort of different, a slightly different cultural ethos on the in some of them. And actually, they've also got a faith-based things for that. So it'd be interesting what you think people are the barriers, and maybe what we could do or think about making it easier, or particularly if you're interested in this kind of area.
Well, I think it's interesting that you bring up autistic thinkers then, because I really think that autistic adults and autistic children, they highlight the drawbacks in the system. They just show us how clearly they show us that the system doesn't work for everybody. And unfortunately, what happens often is that there's a kind of attitude, we kind of say, well, okay, so these people have special educational needs, they're different, they need something different, but it's okay for everybody else. I don't think our system is really okay for most of us. I think it, you know, it works on its own terms, but that's because the terms that have been set are usually quite limiting. You know, we're basically saying, how do we get children to get to this end where they pass their GCSEs and they pass their A levels? That is the aim of this whole system that we're doing. For most kids, that's what it's like. It's not always that. There are some exceptional schools which don't take that approach. But once we've defined that end point as we want you to get the top grades that you can in these GCSEs, then we've limited what we're thinking that this child is going to do through their education. And I think when I talk to parents of children, of autistic children or of children with special educational needs, they're often more open to thinking about different ways of doing things, because I think it's because partly they can see so clearly that their child isn't going to thrive in that conventional system. Whereas it's harder for parents who maybe think that their child might do well in this system to see that the emotional damage that it's doing to them, or the other damage. And I suppose the other part of where my puzzle of what came in for me was that, well, I work as a clinician, I'm a clinical psychologist, I work with adults as well as young people and children. And I know as a psychologist that when somebody comes along feeling powerless and feeling they have no control over things, it's associated with all sorts of negative feelings about themselves, and also all sorts of difficulties with making changes in their life that they might want to make changes about. Because, and then it just seemed weird to me that we sort of induce that sense of powerlessness in our children, that we say for them, for example, you can't wear a coloured jumper. I can't really see where, educationally, I can't see what the justification would be for saying everybody has to have the identical jumper. It's control. It's about controlling young people. And I think we're all, you know, if you go to school from the start, and maybe particularly if you're a relatively high achiever and therefore you get lots of approval at school and lots of kind of validation, you kind of slowly get into this system of control. You know, by the time you're 17 or 18, you're so used to being told exactly what you've got to wear, exactly what you've got, how you've got to cut your hair, the shoes you wear, all of that kind of stuff. You don't even really question it anymore, because it's just how it's always been. And I suppose that was something I really noticed coming in and out of the UK system, that a different system didn't have those requirements and seemed to manage fine. So why did the UK think it was so important to have that control?
I guess, is that all about agency? I guess so. I'm not from the school of thought, so it's probably, I'm going to do their argument weaker, but they would, I guess someone like the Michaela School or something would argue, well, uniforms make the certain culture, you follow certain rules, and that will help learning. You have less choice. I'm describing it badly because it means to me it's like that is a system of control and systems, and you're preparing people for the workplace, but what sort of work do you want them to do? But there is that, there is this idea that I think they argue from rules or routine, or and then they go fast to say is that knowing a lot of knowledge comes through that. And I guess maybe it's because it's roots of just understanding, and I think you mentioned this in the book, just a tiny slice of what behaviorism or sort of Pavlovian learning has done, which is not the whole of learning. It's a certain section of learning for a certain thing, and they've carried it through to a very far conclusion in a straight line, drawing from just two or three little dots, which are definitely true in themselves,
That's so good.
but don't do that.
Tiny slice is a lovely way of putting it, because I think it applies to the cognitive stuff as well. It's
Yes.
like,
I mean, it's obviously true in its
you
little
take a
thing, but it's
tiny,
not the
it
whole.
works. It works. So when people say, but is that there's not a problem with the science. There isn't a problem with the behavioral science as it is defined and how it is used. There's not a problem with the cognitive science. The studies do show what they say they say, though. That's absolutely indisputable. The problem is that when that becomes your approach to childhood and learning and education and everything, when you talk about creating a culture, I suppose my question would be, why do we want to create a culture of conformity? Because that's what we're doing. We're creating a culture of conformity. And our people often say, they say, we set up these rules and regulations and things, and children will learn these things and then they'll carry them all the way through life. Well, okay, but carrying the, I don't know how useful that is in terms of let's train our children to conform and not to question and to do what they're told without making a fuss about it. Well, that only takes you so far in life, really. And I suppose I'm sure I'm not alone. I know I'm not alone in this kind of feeling I observed in my peers, which was that we went through all the process of education. We were all high achievers at university. That's why we were there, because we'd done well in the system. And we got to there, and then you come to the end, and then you're kind of like, well, now what? People have basically been telling me what to do all the way through this system. And now I've got to the point where I'm not being told what to do anymore. And I'm what, maybe 24? And I've never really made big, significant choices about my life. And I think it's really at odds with the cognitive neuroscience findings, which are showing that in order to develop that kind of system in your brain, the prefrontal cortex, the way of, the part that enables us to make decisions, we need those experiences. And have you read Sarah Jane Blakemore's work about the adolescent
Yes.
brain? I think her stuff fits so well with what I talk about, because I think what's happening when we have self-directed education is that we are giving young people lots of practice in making those kinds of decisions, in making decisions for themselves. And we know that part of the brain matures in an experience dependent way. So if we give children lots and lots and lots of experience of doing what they're told, keeping the rules, not stepping out of line, then that's what they're learning. That's what they're, it's all learning. I suppose I'm frustrated at the way that schools define learning as the stuff that in the curriculum, because I think we have to look at everything that a child is doing at school. They are learning from all of it. And actually, from my own memories of school, what I learned outside the classroom has stuck with me much longer than the actual stuff I learned in the classroom.
Sure. Obviously, I'm going to agree with all of that. I guess I'll go a step further. When I look now out into the world, and you think about what governments or people claim they want, so innovation, new ideas, creativity, critical skills thinking, they've got all fancy terms for it. But if you think, where do new discoveries come from? Where do you push ideas which haven't been thought before? Well, they don't tend to come from conforming to the system. They do not tend to come from a bureaucracy, because by their nature they are, well, whatever the rules are set for me and that. And so when the rules are wrong, either scientifically or morally, if you've been told to just conform to them, well, that's no good, because you'll be following something as a false premise. You need to somehow have learned to question something, either again, scientifically, morally, or whatever. And a school system which is just, or any system which has taught you just to obey, doesn't get there. And I think this is where it goes to the roots I briefly mentioned, or we mentioned, is Victorian roots, because they did or purposely wanted a system of control. And we can we can argue rightly or wrongly about how important that was for the Industrial Revolution, where people were a lot poorer and no one could read and write. So that, but to use a system which had, has basically, I don't know, what maybe you would probably know more, but hasn't really evolved in 150 years of thinking, whereas the cognitive science, even educational pedagogy in its kind of small field, seems to have gone on, you know, a quantum leap in knowledge. The way we school has not, and there's not too many areas, although there's some, like maybe buildings, actually we haven't seemed to have made a quantum leap in there. but in a lot of the knowledge, you know, the knowledge rich industry, say, and I find that's really fascinating about, well, why is it, do we not seem to know? And because my posit, and again, there's not been huge worldwide studies on it, but I would guess if you could do a controlled trial of, I don't know, like a few thousand people who go through some form of child-centered learning in any, I mean, there's many variations, but in any of its variation, and you control that to some control form in any of its variations, I think you will end up with better outcomes for those. And maybe the academic outcomes of having that will be roughly equal. But I think all of the other outcomes in terms of critical thinking or happiness or anxiety and all of those, from what I'm thinking, would be higher. I would strongly bet quite a lot on that hypothesis. But I haven't seen the study. I don't think the study will be done.
No one's done
the study. And why are there not 10,000 of those studies as opposed
to... Because school is the invisible intervention, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't realise until I thought about not sending my children to school, I didn't realise that everything I had been taught in my developmental psychology courses at university, in my PhD, everything assumed that all the children were at school and didn't even mention it, because that was the assumption, that they were always at school. And it's been such an interesting ride for me, watching my own children, but also watching children around me, because of course I now know lots of other children who don't go to conventional school, and thinking to myself, wow, I wonder how many of the things that I was taught as child development and how humans develop was actually child development in the context of school. Because 30 hours a week is a massive intervention. You know, we do these control studies for psychology interventions. It's 1 hour a week. We think that like 12 hours once a week is a lot. That's in the NHS. That's a lot. That's quite, you know, 20 sessions is quite a long-term intervention. They're at school for 30 hours a week. And nobody ever set up the random control style at the beginning. Never. The Victorians definitely didn't say, we'll just see. You know, if these children are in a rich learning environment where other people are literate, and that is really important, you know, because people always say to me, are you saying children will just learn? No, you need these things in your environment. Of course, there are children all over the world who aren't learning to read and write because their environment doesn't have the necessary information for them to do that. The adults around them can't read and write. And that's part of what the Victorians were working with. The Victorians were thinking, we have a largely illiterate population. We need them to be literate. Let's get the children in. We can deliver this and they will learn how to do it. And it worked. But we're not in that situation now. You know, our population is largely literate. We don't know what children learn when they don't go to school simply from being around other people, following their interests. And it was such a moment for me when I was looking into this before, when my own children were, I was thinking about not sending my own children to school. And I looked at the research done on self-directed education and on schooling. And I was thinking, wow, so if it really is true that you don't have to go to school and you kind of come out at a quite similar place, but without having had lots of the difficult experiences that lots of people have at school, why don't more people know about this? What? Because people feel trapped in school. And I think that's a serious issue. It's definitely an issue for many autistic people and parents of autistic children, that they feel like this is really going wrong. I think this is doing a lot of damage to my child. But I don't think there's anything else I can do. We're told school is the only way. And when you're saying how, you know, how come we, I think schooling works. And I think the most effective thing it teaches us is that we must be schooled. We have to go to school. And we're taught that right from the age of three, right through till we're 18.
Yeah. And I guess there is another way. And I think anecdotally, if you go back to the Victorians, their rich elites didn't do
they
the
had
school
something
system.
Different.
So there is a sort of not quite paired control, but you can see how and they did quite well.
Yeah.
And I think I do see some studies, it's not necessarily always child-led, but tend to be these small group mastery type of things, but often are actually very influenced by what the child wants to do. It's often like a child and adult kind of choose, or there's a sort of selection of choice. So it's not 100% child-led, but it's not, oh, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
So they end up, if they want to do maths all week or whatever, they go, okay, we'll do that. So
yeah,
it's not quite 100% 0% curriculum or that.
Yeah.
I was wondering, it's interesting now, if you think about it, sort of maybe turning to sort of some of the practice rather than the theory, and we can go a little bit as to what it might mean to de-school. But even if you're not, I guess I'm moderately techno-optimist about the world. And I think people miss a lot about how children use technology, in the same way that I think, you know, people were really worried about reading and newspapers a couple of hundred years ago and things. And so, for instance, I've spent, I'm pretty sure, hundreds of hours in the world of Minecraft with both of my sons, one who's more of an autistic thinker, one who's probably a little bit less of an autistic thinker. And I've seen whole worlds open up. Some of them have used this kind of Discord chat thing. There's a whole community out there. It's not necessarily adults excluded, but most adults I know, certainly if you're over the age of 40, will typically not know anything about these Discord communities. And there are some of the biggest communities in the world. And I learned so much about both creativity, what they might think, how they think, and some of these decisions that you make in a world of digital pixels, but which actually does reflect our own world. And I was wondering what you think about how people use technology as well. Or I guess it comes to what you sort of said earlier, you know, you can lean into technology or you can lean into time in the woods. It kind of depends on how the child is learning. But do you find that people, parents or families, are almost, they can be too technology phobic if that is what their child is learning?
Definitely. People, it's one of the number one things that families come to me worried about. They say, screen time is what they say. I'm really worried about screen time. You know, they've got way too much screen time, particularly if children come out of school. Because when you're in school, you know, you have all these hours every day when you can't be on your device because you're at school and you're not allowed to take your device with you. And then you come back and you have to be in bed by a certain time. Your whole day is structured in a way that means that you can't spend 8 hours of it playing Minecraft. And then the child's now home educated and, you know, they will be, and I, yeah.
They can do 8 hours.
They can
Minecraft.
Spend 8 hours playing Minecraft. And I also have spent hundreds and hundreds of hours playing Minecraft. Some of the best memories when my children were little were us all playing Minecraft together. And I think there are many different ways that children use technology. But I do think that fear, when I talk to parents who are frightened of it, and I talk to a lot of them, they often have very little idea of what their children are actually doing on it. And typically they'll say things like, oh, it's so isolating, you know, they're not connecting with other people, it's passive, they'll say. They have all these words that trot out. And none of them really make any sense to me when I spend time with my children on a screen, because it's generally not at all passive. Minecraft is certainly, if you're passive, you're not going to get anywhere in Minecraft. You just get there, you sit there, and nothing happens until you're killed by a zombie or something. You know, you have to be active. But also, there's so much that children can do on their devices. It's a place where they can feel really competent. And one of the theories I write about in my book is self-determination theory. And I think it's a lot of what underpins self-directed education. And it says there are three things children need, or adults need, in order to have this kind of intrinsic motivation. It's autonomy, competence, and relatedness. And competence is this kind of feeling, I can do it. It doesn't have to be being good at something. It's this sort of sense of, you know, this is something I could do. And I think you see children getting that in Minecraft when they don't get it anywhere else. And I often work with parents whose children are really unhappy at school, are really struggling, and video games are the only place they're really happy, and their parents are worried about it. And I think that's so sad, because, you know, the only thing which is really bringing this child to life is a thing that their parent is trying to limit. And so I always say to parents, get alongside them, sit with them, learn how to play it. And they say, oh, I don't know how to start with Minecraft. I say, watch the YouTube videos. There are loads of YouTube videos showing you how to get started with Minecraft. Just go in there and have a go. And I've actually played enormous numbers of video games, with my son in particular. My son is really into video games. And the interesting thing is that neither of my children have limits on how much time they can spend on their device. So, and that has always been the case. My son, now at 14, is spending a lot of his time coding. So he played games a lot, and now he is making games all the time, writing games. He's taught himself how to code using Code Academy, and he is just he's in game development basically most of the time. My daughter isn't really into spending any time on a device. She she's into making stuff, and she always has been. She's into constructing, painting, you know, she's really creative with her hands. And people often say to me, but what about addiction? Aren't you worried about addiction? And I mean, you know, we both know as psychologists, addiction is about so much more than the thing. You know, it's you can be addicted to all sorts of things, yeah. But it's not just about the thing. It's not like, I mean, alcohol is a prime example, that alcohol is all around in our society. Some people are addicted to alcohol, some people aren't. And why is that? It's generally about everything in their lives and the way that they're using alcohol. And I do see some children who I think they're using withdrawal into a video game because the rest of their life is so unhappy. And they are very attached to it. And parents will say, you know, we try and get them off it, and they shout and scream, they must be addicted. And I say, no, I think it's that you need to think about what's going on in the whole rest of their life. And let's think about that. Let's make that better. And then, because limiting the thing that they really enjoy, banning it or making it restricted, isn't going to make their life happier. We can pretty well guarantee that. And I think the more that parents lean into it, the less fearful it becomes, because the more they can see what their children are actually doing.
It's their happy place. And I have, my youngest has taught me so, in fact, both of them have, through these YouTube videos, because a bunch of them teach better than most teachers. And a whole range of esoteric thought from wars in China, how the US Senate works, to the latest in alternative proteins. The sheer variety.
It's amazing. Which is, and then they bring it out, don't they? And it's such a surprise. They're like, and you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't know that. But why should we prescribe? Because you make this point in the book, because that's kind of what I would use the term, that's what adulting is, right? Adults, you go, you find this thing and you go that. And I think adults spend probably, most people like in knowledge work industries, if they've gotten into that, they're on their screens 8 to 10 hours. Okay, some of it is in Excel spreadsheets, but some of it is on Facebook or YouTube or whatever it is. I'm interested, what else, maybe practically, maybe our own stories then. So I did a lot of Minecraft, you did a lot of Minecraft.
Yeah.
We do some handcrafting as well. But what else have you learned from your children, do you think? What are a couple of pivotal things or skills, or maybe anything which has surprised you or not surprised you?
Okay, so there are a few things, there are loads of things that have surprised me. And I suppose one thing that surprised me was when we started out with this, I had the assumption, which I think lots of parents have, which is that, you know, play-based learning is great when they're younger, and that our system cuts that off too short, too early. 4 or 5 is too early to stop playing, to make, you know, to try and channel them into more formal education. And so I thought, we'll let them play for longer, and by the time they're about 7, they'll probably be ready for some more formal work. And, you know, you read about education systems in Denmark, a place where they don't start more formal education till 8. And I was like, okay, that'll be fine. They get to 7. In no way were they in any way interested in any kind of formal work. So I was like, and in fact, when by the time they got to 7, I would say that the gap between them and what a school child was doing had widened. And I was perhaps thinking it wouldn't. I was thinking that they would mature and it would sort of shrink. And actually, it's just widened and widened and widened, because what I saw was that they were developing in a different way. So both of my children learned to read much later than I would have expected them to. You know, we are very literate environment. I learned to read at the age of about 3. I love reading. We have books everywhere. You know, I thought that they would be reading early. My son learned to read between the age of about 8 and 10. And he started the first word that I knew he read, well, kind of, he looked at a sign on the road and he said, does that say zombie? Now, you're going to get the reference of why he was able to read the word zombie. It didn't say zombie, it said zone. So, and in Minecraft is this amazing game where everything has the name underneath. So he started reading things like obsidian, and all these words that, you know, he learned from Minecraft. And it took a long time as well. People sometimes say, oh, you know, they've got to learn to read, it all clicks into place. And I was like, okay, we've started to learn to read now, it'll all click into place. It was actually about 2 years before he was a fluent reader. And now he is a really fluent reader. He's just read The Lord of the Rings. And, you know, he's an enthusiastic reader. He reads books for pleasure all the time. And yet he wasn't doing that. So I think that really surprised me. And the other thing that I saw, which I think is really important, is how lots of children, they sort of cycled round to doing things in a way that I think school stops people doing. So talking particularly about imaginative play, I noticed that lots of children that I saw around me weren't, who would have been either, they were autistic, they might have had diagnosis, might not have had diagnosis, but many children weren't playing imaginatively in those early years, which, you know, as a clinical psychologist, you've been taught, you're looking for this, you're looking for them to be playing imaginatively in these early years, really important, they should be doing all this. Quite a few of the children I saw around me weren't doing that. They were much more interested in facts and feelings or Minecraft or doing other stuff. But what I would see is that as they got older, they would start playing imaginatively at a much later age, like 8 or 9, at the point where many schooled children had really moved on from that stage completely. So it was often connected to the video games they played. So I'd see a lot of children playing real life Minecraft, real life Plant versus Zombies. And again, their parents would kind of have sometimes a slightly derogatory approach, a denigrating approach to that. They kind of say, oh, well, you know, it's not like real imaginative play because it's derived from this other stuff. But I would be like, it is real. It's in their imagination. In fact, I mean, I think a lot of imaginative play goes on in Minecraft. And I think for lots of autistic kids in particular, that's where loads of imaginative stuff goes on. And it's not really seen by the adults around them, because what they're looking for when they're thinking about imagination is tea parties and playing school and all this kind of teddy bears and dolls. And that we haven't got a kind of roadmap for what later, more as play gets more sophisticated, if children are allowed to continue to play without being stopped from doing so, we haven't really got a roadmap for how that becomes so much more sophisticated. And that was just a moment of real insight for me and interest.
Wow, yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so I'm going to ask for 2-3 pieces of consulting, if I may, then.
Okay.
So one is a question of sort of, again, practically around this area. I have a lot of discussion with people around giving children this wide choice. So parents mm-hmm. often kind of feel like, oh, I want to like have a basic level of maths, or you've done it with reading,
yeah,
and things like that. I want to give them choice, but that, and I guess the sort of purer child-centered way of thinking is that, well, you keep the environment rich and they will fall into it in times of reading and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I hear a lot, particularly on the maths bit as well, maybe reading has come from that time. How do you balance, or do you even balance, some of the things you might want to expose your children to, maybe because you just really love it yourself? So I guess mm-hmm. you know, part of it is I do my sort of things like podcasting or whatever, and children may or may not naturally pick up yours. But I do get this thing from others I talk about, oh, I'm really worried and I need to do this, or to what level can you shape a curriculum or not, and your thinking around that? Mm-hmm. And then my second question around this is, maybe this is a little bit more, tends to be sometimes a little bit more for people with an autistic profile, but not only, is sometimes we all, whether actually adults or children, is we kind of lose control. Mm-hmm. I really don't like the word tantrum, so people think about this, because it actually, in my view, mostly it is not. Because mm-hmm. it tends to be a sensory overload, or something hasn't gone things, or it's not triggered in that. So we work a lot on trying to sort of get regulation and emotional regulation, and we can talk about the development of that in that. But again, I know a lot of people within this, and particularly, I guess, within a home education environment, they're kind of worried about, oh, we don't have the techniques and methods for dealing with dysregulation or where it goes mm-hmm. really wrong, and some people might hit out, or some people might do whatever there is. So I guess those are my two thoughts that you have from your field and your experience about so one is, I guess, the kind of more positive learning aspect. How do we think about giving that really wide range of richness, and is it okay to nudge or not, depending on your things? Mm-hmm. And the second is on the other side of like when things are suddenly going wrong, when they do it or people get dysregulated. How should we think about that? Is there a there is a different way? And this is probably because they would have exhausted all of the other things that they're normally being told about this type of behavior, and this has led to it, right? Which is why they're now thinking of that. So I think we can assume that a lot of the regular ways, or don't quote work. Unquote regular ways,
have been done. Have been tried. Okay, so let me start with the maths. So a lot of people say that to me as well. They say, can't we just ensure, isn't it so important that we can't just leave it up to chance? And I usually say, in my opinion, things that are really important are too important to make children do. Because we know, I don't have the studies to mind, but we know that an awful lot of children finish the school system thinking they can't do maths, or actually not able to do basic maths. You know, you can be taught maths for 12 years, if they're 11, 12 years, and come out the end still struggling with basic number concept. It isn't a guarantee. So the way I see self-directed education really is that we're providing the opportunities and the environment for learning to occur. And the moment that we bring in compulsion, we have messed that up a bit, basically. The moment we've said, you must do this, we've taken away some of that ideal intrinsic motivation environment, which is going to change the child's relationship with that thing. So some children might be like, yeah, you know, I love maths. That's great. I don't mind if we're going to do maths every morning because I really enjoy it. Okay, that's fine. That child's intrinsic motivation probably won't be bothered. I actually was a math lover and I was a bit like that. You know, what frustrated me in maths was that I was always like, it was just boring because I'd done it all of the, but I was like, once I was allowed to accelerate in maths, I love maths. I would be doing maths for the joy of it. But also, there's nothing in self-directed education which says you can't offer stuff, make suggestions, have it in your environment. What the bit that you can't do is compel them to do it. So we have maths and stuff around, or we had, like, you know, maths manipulatives when they were little, and those, whatever they called them, can't remember, you know, when you have those sort of all the different number cubes and all that kind of stuff, we had it all around. You by doing this podcast, your sons are going to be exposed to that as a thing that's happening. If they're interested, they know how they can go and learn more about podcasting. They may never be, and they may not choose to. And if you said to them, right, you must learn about podcasting, one of my aims for your education is that you will come out of this able to make a good podcast at the end of it, the likelihood is that you would immediately, I don't know what your sons would be like, but certainly if I said that to my children, that would probably pretty well guarantee that they weren't going to learn how to do podcasting.
In fact, never podcast ever.
Yeah, yes.
Entire lifetime.
Exactly. And my children, I think, you know, when you have a child like this, my son is like this, I think they're such a gift because they make you really, really alert to any kind of hidden agenda. My best Minecraft story is that I read stuff about Minecraft online when my son was quite young, and I thought Minecraft would be great. I thought we should do it. I suggested it to my son, and he would not even look at it for a good year afterwards. He was like, no, I downloaded it, right? I bought it on the iPads, I downloaded it. I said, oh, let's have a look at this game. He was like, no, I'm not interested. And that was kind of his approach to suggestions from me at this stage in his life. And every time I would kind of bring it up, I'd try and casually bring it up, and he'd be like, no, we're not playing that boring game. The only reason we got into Minecraft was we were at some gathering. He saw another child building a house in Minecraft, and he was like, oh, actually, I'd quite like to have a go at that. Didn't comment, didn't say anything about the fact we'd had it on the iPad for a year. But he had to come to it in his own way. And I think that's the case for so many kids. And he has played Minecraft. He's sort of almost coming to the end of his Minecraft playing now, but he has been playing Minecraft for like 8 years, and it has developed along with him. It's amazing to see, you know, they can code and everything in Minecraft. But I almost killed it at the beginning by being too enthusiastic. And his math story is really interesting because I learned from things like the Minecraft, I learned that I needed to really keep back off, provide opportunities, but don't push them, don't make them a compulsion, because the moment you do that, you've introduced that element potentially of resistance. So he did no maths at all until he was 12. And I didn't introduce any kind of formal mathematics. We had workbooks, you know, I had them around, but he wasn't interested, didn't want to look at them, didn't want to do it, so I didn't do it. Then he went to this place that he's at now, the Self-Managed Learning College in Hove, where they have learning advisors and where you can say, I want to learn this, and they will help you do it. And the learning advisors will do a group, so they do one-to-ones on you, but it's, again, it has to come from you. They're not going to say, right now, you need to do maths. He started doing maths. He absolutely loves maths. He's now 2 years in and he's working sort of above a GCSE level, having done nothing and really nothing until he was 12. And I think it's just because he, you know, he watches videos, like you're saying about YouTube. He looks up videos about maths on YouTube. He watches stuff. He even at some point said, I'm going to go back and just like go through the whole of Khan Academy and look at all the earlier maths in case I've missed anything. Because he's motivated. And so when you're motivated, you learn these things in a whole different way. And I think because the school system takes away that motivation from children, because it says, this is what you have to learn, we've decided what you're going to have to learn, things take a really long time and they have to be done in a slow and ponderous way. And when then we, because we're mostly schooled, we come out thinking that that's how it had to be done. We think you had to have 12 years of maths, for example, or you'd never be a mathematician. But actually, I think a lot of that early stuff is what people are learning is math is hard. Math is something that I'm not really good at. You know, I don't know how to work this out. And they're learning all those things along with the maths. And if we just back off from it, they don't learn those things. But I don't think there's anything to stop parents having an influence. And that's what sometimes parents sort of equate unschooling or self-directed education as, we don't do anything unless they bring it. That isn't what it's about. It's just about, it's around, but we don't make you do it. We don't insist.
It's the agency point.
Yeah.
And what happens when children get dysregulated, sort of the other side?
Yes. So, okay. So that's, I guess it's another thing that it's important to know that that isn't something that schools have got sussed.
Not at all.
So it's not like we're, you know, yes, the maths people are kind of saying, well, at school they've been doing maths, but... So lots of children have meltdowns.
Isn't this even worse? Like go and sit in isolation on the naughty step or something. It's like, gosh. Right, like,
yes.
At least maths works for some people in school. Yeah. I think this dysregulation bit works for basically no one. Nobody. But anyway, I'm interested in your thoughts.
So, I mean, I think that one way that I find helpful to think about this is basically that what happens is that when children have accumulation of stresses around them, they get pushed over the point of what they can manage, and we come out of the window of tolerance. You know about the window of tolerance idea? Should I talk about that briefly? Or
yes, why yes, not?
Okay. So the idea of the window of tolerance is that we all have a zone in which we can cope with psychological stressors. We can cope with the things that happen to us. We're kind of calm and engaged. We're able to learn. If something happens, we're able to kind of manage it. We're able to be flexible within that zone, basically. If things happen that push us out of that zone, we go two ways. We either go into the fight or flight response, which is a kind of danger response, really. It's the kind of, I need to fight something or I need to run away. Or we can go into a kind of more shutdown response, a freeze response or the fawn response, which is kind of like going floppy, submitting. And those are all responses that are designed to keep us safe. It's the survival part of our brain. It's a pretty primitive part, and it's basically our brain trying to keep us alive. It's responding as if it's responding to threat, and it's responding as if the threat is a wild animal. If you're about to be attacked by a lion, really your choices are, well, with a lion fighting is probably not going to be great unless it's maybe a baby lion, but you're going to run away, you're going to fight it, you're going to freeze, hope it doesn't notice, or you're going to fawn and you're going to play dead, and you're going to hope that it'll just kind of bat you around and then go off. So when children go out of their window of tolerance, they go into this zone where they're not really processing information rationally anymore. Because when you're in your survival system, you know, your point is about keeping your life, keeping yourself alive. It's not about listening carefully to what's being said to you. So I think what parents can often find is that if their children have quite a narrow window of tolerance sometimes, and we expect toddlers to have a low window, narrow window of tolerance. We know that toddlers often get out of their window of tolerance because they're offered the wrong color cup, for example, or because, you know, their food is slightly darker, that they haven't got, you haven't got chicken nuggets today, or the chicken nuggets are a slightly different shape to how they're meant to be, or it's dinosaurs rather than chickens, or all sorts of things can push children out of their window of tolerance, and then they have these meltdowns. We expect children to grow out of that relatively quickly, and lots of children don't. And I think that this is a bit like I was talking about before, that we have this kind of schooled form of thinking about how development should happen, that by the time children are 4 or 5, they should be past this stage. They should not be going into these meltdowns anymore. They should be able to regulate themselves better. Loads of children can't. Loads of children need more help with it. So I think the number one thing for me is seeing that as distress, seeing it as an overwhelmed child, and seeing it as a situation which it's, you're not going to be able to rationalize that child out of. You're not going to be able to punish that child out of. You're not going to be able to say, do something right, and then it will all go away. Effectively, in that moment, it's just about, we need to calm the nervous system down. We need to help soothe you, to help you bring yourself back into this window of tolerance, because lots of children can't do that. Once they're out, once they're into meltdown, they don't know what to do with it. And it's really frightening. It's really frightening for them. So I think the big shift that I find parents can make is, if you're just seeing this as, this is distress, and that there's nothing that I can, this isn't something I've done, because parents will often say, why are they behaving like this? It's bad behavior. It's not bad behavior. There's nothing intentional about this. This is the child showing you that the demands of the situation has out, it's, what's the word? It's too much for them. They cannot manage the demands of the situation whilst keeping themselves within their window of tolerance. And so, bam, you see this.
So that makes them. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And based on my own experience, I would say that is true. And the ability to regulate back down before you can do anything. I have a pet theory, actually. This is why. So we say it's in children. I actually think a lot of adults don't really have this nailed either. And that's actually why you see in the workplace, even these kind of, and I guess it comes out in this, what we interpret as either bullying or harassment, yeah, or this anger and these things. But actually, if you think about it, as how we think a toddler or whatever,
yeah,
is actually a lot of adults go out of their window of tolerance. They don't have the mechanisms, or they're out of it, and then they're in this other system which leads them to all of these quote unquote irrational behaviors. But it's,
yes, because they're not thinking rationally, because actually the survival system cuts off all that rational thought, because you cannot afford to think rationally when there might be a lion about to attack you. You just got to get out of there.
Yeah, exactly. So this happens. This happens a lot more. Great. Yeah. Did you have something else you wanted to comment on that? Otherwise, I have other couple of questions.
No. I was just going to say, I think you're right. And I think that one of the things that happens at school, perhaps, or that is that children are learn to kind of not show that distress, but they don't necessarily actually learn how to manage it. So, because you have to not show things at school, don't you? I mean, that's the kind of key thing at school. You need to not show if you're feeling distressed, because everybody will notice, and you might feel, there are all sorts of reasons why you...
We talk a lot about it in communities I speak to, about, essentially they say the word masking, because there's a lot of masking. And actually, we talk about it in that, but I think it's true that actually there's masking overall for everyone.
I think in schools are full of children basking. I mean, and workplaces as well, right? Yeah. I mean, actually, that's what you have to do. It's a functional response that humans need to have, these kind of different ways of being in different situations. The problem is when it means that you're squashing down your own emotions in order to project that kind of different way of being.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so I have a couple of questions in from readers, listeners, social media, Twitter. Please follow Naomi on Twitter if you're a Twitter type of person. And so one was around COVID and the pandemic. And I guess this actually had two parts. One was whether the experience of home education was maybe more resilient or different, I guess, for those already doing it. And then the other one is, like, it gave people, I think, a glimpse as to how bad trying to do school at home on Zoom didn't work versus this other thing. And then the second question I have, which has come through this, which we hasn't touched on, is I guess the kind of potential critique of saying, isn't this just a kind of rich person, middle class person way of doing that? You know, if you have a lot of resources, if you have the privilege or luxury of doing that. And I guess there's a hint of truth to that because of the system, but I'd be interested, I think you have a much more comprehensive view, and how that maybe isn't just the case. So one, I guess, is thinking around the pandemic, and the second is, you know, is this just a rich person's thing?
Yeah, okay. So the pandemic, I think, really interesting. I mean, what happened with the pandemic? I think their families responded in so many different ways. Like, as I think you said in the question, many families tell me that they were quite horrified to see what their children were doing, and also how hard it was to keep their children doing the stuff they were meant to be doing for school. And I thought that was really interesting, because I think it was like the control that goes on at school was suddenly brought into homes. And so, you know, how I was saying how a child at home has much more power than a child at school, and therefore I think any home educated child is going to be more autonomous than a school child, unless they're from an extremely, they're probably asked homes like this, if unless they're from a very strict and controlling home who deliberately set out to be very strict and controlling. But with COVID, suddenly the classes were happening, the children were behind the computer screens, and it was up to the parents to try and keep the children on task. And the parents discovered how much the children didn't really want to be on task, or how much they weren't really interested in what they were doing. And so I was actually really hopeful for a time with the pandemic. I was like, maybe everybody will realize that we don't, maybe we should be doing things with children that doesn't require this degree of control that we don't even see. You know, I think it's weird that we don't see the control in a whole set of 6 or 7 year olds, all seated in rows, all dressed in the same clothes, all in one classroom with other children their age, with one teacher at the front. We did it. We were all put through that system, and so we don't see it as controlling. But if we came from another planet, we'd be like, this is a really odd thing that they do to their children. They dress them all up in the same way, and they make them all sit at the same desk, and then they make them all do the same thing. But that control is invisible to us because it was done to us. So I felt quite hopeful about that with the pandemic. But actually what happened was lots of parents were like, phew, we can send them back to school where we haven't got to do the control bit ourselves. But there were also parents who found that their children were much happier once they were out of school. And I think that was a bit of a revelation for parents who had thought that their children were just the way they were, you know, quite dysregulated generally, or quite unhappy, quite stressed. And then suddenly school stopped, their children were at home. These were often the parents who gave up quite early on with them making them do the Zoom stuff, which some parents did. And they would be like, wow, everything is more relaxed. House is much more relaxed. Things are more generally much more relaxed. Why are we doing this? Why are we making them go to school? So I've known quite a lot of parents who haven't sent their children back to school after COVID for that reason. But I think the question also was whether the impact of COVID was less on home educated children. I think that's very dependent. I don't think that's necessarily the case, because most home educated children do go to see other children. They go to groups, they go to outings, they go to visit places, and all of that stopped. So I think that for lots of children, their lives became much more limited. I think they were probably less affected in a way than the school children, because they usually already have friends online. They already had connections with other children online, and often their parents will have already had a more relaxed attitude to screens, which probably helped, because by that point, everything had to be by a screen. I talked to quite a few parents, schooling parents, this is, who were really worried about the amount of time their children were spending on screens during COVID. And I was like, well, this is the only thing that they can do that connects them with the rest of the world. I mean, in a way, isn't it amazing that when we had this lockdown, that we had it at a time that we were able to make these connections via technology? Because if we hadn't been, wow, our children would have been very limited. But I think the impact is just, it's variable. It's probably as many impacts as there are children.
Yeah. And in some ways, everyone's agency was lowered or taken away for various reasons.
Completely, it was, wasn't it?
And so, I mean, that is why,
yeah,
arguably all nations were stressed, right? As along with everything else,
I think
through the agency framework, along with everything else.
Totally, and I think our ideas of what choices we had about our lives, and our children's ideas of what choices we as parents had about their lives, were really shaken. So yes, we didn't know, did we? I didn't really know that the government could simply say, right, everybody, you've got to stay at home, we're closing everything down. And you know, it was a shock to know that they could do that and that that could happen. But I think it was a shock for children to see that that could happen to their parents, because children, younger children in particular, think their parents are all powerful. They think their parents are the ones who can make things happen. And suddenly their parents also can't go out of the house or can't go to work. Or I think, you know, it's a huge psychological shock across the board, really, for everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you want to say, yeah.
Yeah. Is this just a rich person's thing?
Yes, I was going to go on to privilege. So I get asked this a lot. And One of the things that I always say is that if you spend any time with the home educating community, you will discover that the way it's perceived from the outside and the people who are really in the inside are very different. So home education or homeschooling in particular in the press is usually portrayed as something which people do to try and hothouse their children, to like, you know, get them into Oxford at age 14 or to allow them to develop some very special skill like tennis or golf, or, you know, that they're going to be these kind of supercharged children with this very, very intensive program. A very high percentage of children in the UK, at least, I don't know about the US and I don't actually know about the research, but I know from my own experience and from surveys that I've seen, a very high percentage of children who are home educated come out of school because they are absolutely not managing school. So some of those children are excluded, or in some cases, their parents think they're heading for exclusion and they take them out before that happens. These families are not a privileged group of families at all. And in fact, I think that the group of families who I've met the least, probably in my experience, have been the more privileged families. And that's because they have the capacity to move their child to a private school, for example, move their child to a school that's much smaller, but you have smaller classes. They have many, many more choices by virtue of having the money. And actually, families for whom school is really, really not going well at all, home education is one of the cheapest things that you can do as an alternative. Because it doesn't require you to pay school fees. And also, a lot of these parents that I talk to, if your child's having a really hard time at school, it's very difficult, or if your child has significant special needs, it's very difficult for families to continue with two parents working. So people often say, well, you have to have a parent at home. Not everybody can afford to have a parent at home. But actually, having a child who's really unhappy at school pretty well requires you to have a parent at home as well, because parents will tell me things like, they'll say, you know, I would drop the child off at school, I get to work, within an hour there'd be a call saying, can you come in please, we can't, you know, they're having a meltdown. Or one parent I talked to for my book said, you know, they're on the porta cabin roof, child's always on the porta cabin roof, and they would call me to come and get my child. And then she said my employer said to me, you're going to have to choose between answering these calls from the school or this job. And she was like, well, there's no choice, is there? I can't say to the school, sorry, just leave him on the porta cabin roof, he'll be fine. So I think there's a real misconception about what who home educators actually are. I think there's a very, very high percentage of special educational needs, and a very high percentage of actually less privileged families who are doing really the only option that they can do when school isn't working for their child, because it is a cheaper option than other choices. But you know, I think there's obviously always a certain amount of privilege in being able to make a choice. I don't think you have to have abundance of stuff in your home to make this choice. There are lots of home education groups where people go and where you can kind of pool resources basically with other families. I know many single parents who've made this choice and who've made people do all sorts of things to work around it. I mean, just in our example, I gave up work in order to home educate my children. I gave up my job in the NHS, which was actually my dream job in the NHS. It was exactly the job I wanted. And the way we made it work was that I worked in the evenings and on Saturdays. So I set up a private practice. So my husband would be at work during the day. He would come back, hand the children over, and I would go down the road and fit in a couple of clients. It was really hard work. I would not recommend it. I used to buy Lucozade at the local shop on the way back, and that literally be jugging it down, because I just had a whole day with a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and now I was going to go in and see clients. But you hear all kinds, you know, people do these things of kind of working around it, because it's like, we need to do something. And I think you'll find that families from all walks of life are doing it.
Yeah, that's my experience too. And I think echoes in the US, where, although there's also a US group which are a little bit faith-based in yes, this as well.
That's different. I don't think we really have that group in the UK in the same way. I've talked to Americans, they always assume we do, but I haven't met many people who are home educating for religious reasons as their major motivation.
Yeah, great. So I have a little section of overrated and underrated. So I'll give you some quick fire and you can say overrated, underrated, or you can pass, or you can make some comments. I actually think now, having had this conversation, I know what you're going to say on all of these, but we can we can see how they go. So overrated or underrated, a government set curriculum.
Completely, well, completely overrated.
Rated.
Yeah.
Does it have
That's
any
really
no redeeming features
no,
whatsoever?
No, I don't think it does. I cannot see why the government would be setting a curriculum. I really can't.
Great. So overrated, underrated, exams. So I guess we would say we have talked about the fact that we're over tested. Is there any place for exams or testing? Can it do anything, or is it pretty much like a waste of time?
I think there's a place for exams as a kind of entry to other things in a very practical way. I think part of the problem with our GCSE and A-level system is there's far too much invested in it, and it's used almost as a way of evaluating whether you are a good and worthwhile person or not for the rest of your life, whether you're going to be a loser or a success. You know, that's how it feels. I would like it if exams were much more like the driving test. You know, if you want to be able to go and drive, you need to show that you've got a certain level of competence in driving. But nobody thinks that that test indicates anything about you as a person, apart from whether you can drive or not. And I can say that because I failed my driving test 3 times. And
I can't
I know
even drive.
You can't drive. Well, there you are. So I don't think you should just be able to go out and drive.
Yeah.
I think you need, it's, you know, we need to have competency-based tests for things. But I don't think we need to, I don't think we should be rating everybody against each other in the way that GCSEs do, because GCSEs aren't actually a competency-based exam. It is about where are you in the spectrum of everybody else. And I think we need to get rid of this idea that everybody does these exams when they're 16, everybody does these exams when they're 18. What I would like to see is, you know, so young person would like to go to be a games designer or something. And in order to do that, they need to demonstrate that they've got certain levels of literacy and numeracy. So they do those because they can see that that's got a point and that's the next thing to do. Do you see what I mean? So it's like, I haven't got a problem with entry requirements and stuff like that and demonstrating competency. But I think that's the real problem with these high stakes exams, because I see so many young people who think that their life is over because they're not going to do GCSEs at 16, for example. They think that this is it. This is the, you know, there's such a high stakes feeling around that whole period of development of adolescence. And I just think that's really unhelpful.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And so overrated, underrated, social media, although I guess we could go social media overall and then social media within children, I guess.
Well, I have mixed feelings about social media, I think, because I think it can be social media in particular, I think, can be a source of lots of bullying for young people. And I do have concerns about the way that if young people are being bullied at school and everybody's on social media, that bullying basically continues around the clock, 24/7. So I think I would be in my approach generally to technology is the parents need to lean into it. Parents need to know what's going on. And I think social media is an amazing tool, but I think it's only as good as the people behind it. You know, it's not a thing in itself. It's the people. And if your child's in a community where they're being bullied a lot, then you might want to rethink whether they're actually always being accessible by that community.
Yeah. Okay. So that's neutral. All right. That makes sense. And then overrated, underrated, technical colleges. So I guess, or a schooling where it's kind of more, I guess, skills based. So not, there is sort of this, but you may be learning, I don't know, carpentry or coding or something. I guess we don't have such a great tradition of that here in the UK, or at least not anymore. But at least the concept of having more, I guess, I don't even really like the term technical college, but it is more of a skills based type of learning, or maybe apprenticeships.
Yeah, more of an apprenticeship based model. I think those would be great if we had more of those for young people. And I think that would go alongside, I mean, again, I don't think that should be enforced on anybody. I don't think it should be, you know, this is what you've got to do. But I think if young people are doing something that's meaningful and that they find rewarding, then I think we would have, many adolescents would have an easier ride, and that society might have an easier ride with them. But I also think it's about getting away from this idea of academic exams being the be all and end all and being the kind of marker. There's a nice YouTube video by Ken Robinson, you know his work.
Yes.
And I think one of the things he says is he says we have this weird system which puts being a university professor at the top of the hierarchy. The skills that we teach children in school are all these academic skills, which I use every day as a university professor. But actually, I'm this tiny part of society. There are so many other things which we don't prioritize in the same way. And it's like we measure everybody against this benchmark of how far did you get towards being a university professor? How many qualifications did you get? And I would just love it if we could see child development and education in a much, much wider way.
Great. Okay. So coming up to the final couple of questions. So one is, what projects are you working on now? Do you have another book or ideas? Obviously, you're running on your own consulting. What's happening today?
Yes, so I've actually just finished my second book on self-directed education yesterday. I sent it off to the editor, and that is on neurodiversity and self-directed education. So it's called A Different Way to Learn, and it's going to be published by Jessica Kingsley Publishers next year, I hope. And for it, I interviewed lots of families with neurodivergent children of all types, and also young people. And I also interviewed neurodivergent adults about their experience of school. So it's a lot more, as compared to my first book, which was more theory based, it's a lot more experienced based. I hope that it will give parents the confidence, because often parents will say to me, oh, you know, but my child's autistic and I've got all these reports that say they must be in school. If they're not at school, you know, it's so common. I find people say so often with autistic children in particular, they've got to be in school to learn how to socialize. And I'm like, how does anybody, that's not what school is for a start. Yeah. But also, have you talked to any autistic people about their experience of socializing at school? And really, what do you think they're learning through it? So I'm kind of trying to give a counterbalance to that. And I'm also, yes, as you say, I'm doing webinars at the moment, and I'm thinking of moving into doing some online courses about how parents can help their autistic children with various different things like anxiety and trauma.
Great. Well, I look forward to reading that. And maybe the final question then is, do you have any life advice or advice for parents and families in your experience, maybe who are thinking about this, or any other observations that you've had about the world?
So I think my number one advice for parents would be, trust your instincts about what your child needs and how your child is. So a lot of parents I talk to, they say, you know, I think that my child is really unhappy, or I think that my child needs these things, but the professionals are telling me that I'm wrong. And I think you need to just retain your knowledge that you know your child better. And you probably have a really good sense. And you don't just know your child better, but in most cases, you share genes with your child. And therefore, you actually often have a kind of intuitive understanding of the experiences that your child is having, and that you can get inside their heads in a way that professionals often can't. And so I would say, really listen to your instincts. Give yourself space to think about what you think, as sort of apart from what everybody tells you you should be thinking. And the other thing is, lean into the things that your child likes. Whatever they are, lean into them and embrace them, because, you know, this is a short time of life when they're like this and when they're young, and it is an amazing opportunity to connect with them if you choose to do that, rather than choosing to pull them away from the things that they love.
That sounds excellent. So follow your intuitions and follow your child's interests. So
pretty well, yeah.
With that, Naomi, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
If you appreciate the show, please like and subscribe, as it helps others find the podcast.